Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, How to Develop Mission-Critical Avionics and Defense Systems with ADA and DDS. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's presenters, David Barnett of Real-Time Innovations and Quentin Oshem of ADA Core. Before we begin, I'd like to more formally introduce our speakers, starting with Quentin Oshem, who is a technical account manager at ADA Core. Quentin has a software engineering background, specializing in software development for critical applications. He has more than 10 years of experience in ADA development, and his responsibilities at ADA Core include leading technical account management, as well as driving business development in projects related to the avionics, railroad, aerospace, and defense industries. Our second presenter today is David Barnett, who is Vice President of Products and Markets at Real-Time Innovations. David has more than 25 years of experience in distributed, real-time, and embedded systems, and is responsible for the company's product roadmap, product marketing, and market development. He joined RTI in 2005, and prior to that was the Vice President of Marketing at a real-time middleware startup acquired by the Borland Software Corporation. He's also been Director of Product Marketing at Green Hills Software and Mentor Graphics, and a Senior Product Marketing Manager at Wind River Systems. David began his career as a software engineering lead at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he was responsible for the design and implementation of several distributed real-time applications. David has a BA in computer science from Cal Berkeley. Now to address the few housekeeping items, starting with the features of your audience viewing console. The Enlarge Slides button will maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. Second, the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you prefer to follow along with a hard copy. Next, Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email that includes a registration link to this eCast so that friends and colleagues can also attend. Importantly, the Ask a Question text box allows you to participate in the event by simply typing your question into the box and hitting Submit Question below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while you're reviewing the material. We'll address as many of these as possible during the closing Q&A, and also if you have questions about the eCast operation itself, feel free to submit those, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. One final note before we begin is a reminder that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. So at this point, I'd like to hand it off to Quentin from ADA Core. Quentin, take it away.
Thank you, Brandon. So I'd like to start with describing briefly who we are at ADA Core, because I don't know if everybody in the attendees list know us. We are basically a tool provider for safe and secure software development environment, and we evolve around primarily one language, which is the ADA language, which has been around for over 30 years now. And the reason why we do that is that we believe that ADA is particularly well suited to develop such application. But we do look at other things as well, and recently we've been looking at other formalisms such as Simulink or C. We were founded about 20 years ago in New York. Today we are about 70 people worldwide, roughly evenly spread between our two headquarters in Paris and New York. The technology that we are developing has been used roughly over 1,200 projects or programs worldwide in those industries that develop high-integrity applications. So you'll see the usual suspects here, the aerospace and defense domain, together with rail transportation, in particular in Europe, air traffic management. And we're seeing an increasing demand on this kind of technology on other domains. We've seen recently interest from the automotive domain, for example, medical devices, or pretty much everything that evolves around the industrial IoT, the Internet of Things, where people realize that it's important to develop software that might be more reliable than what has been done before. And ADA is a very interesting player and contender. What's interesting about this number is that when you look at it from the perspective of some other technology and languages, it might seem very small, but if you look at it from the market niche that we work in, which is really security, safety, reliability, And if you consider the length of the lifetime of some of these projects, it's actually quite a large number. 400 of these 1,200 projects, 400 are currently active customers here at AdaCore, some of which have been here since the very inception of the company. The expertise of the company started around compilation. We were founded out of a research project that was awarded to the New York University back in 1994, and we built the company around this. And over the years, we've expanded our knowledge following requirements from our customers. So we went to compilation only on native system to a various wealth of embedded platforms, which includes today runtime operating systems, RTOS, such as VxWorks or Linksys or those kind of things. We support bare platforms. We can target, for example, with Ada, we can target the ARM, M3, M4, R4, bare target without an operating system. We can target very small systems such as AVR 8-bits, and we can even target some more modern environments such as the Android targets. We actually do have customers that are developing Ada application that needs to be portable between native system like a Windows box or a Linux box and an Android platform and secure communication between those two things. We have other tools for verification. As you know, when you develop safe and secure software, well, one very important aspect of it is to be able to verify the code, verify that the behavior of the code is as intended. So we've developed technologies around verification, may that be testing and dynamic analysis or static analysis. And static analysis is an interesting one. I'll discuss some more of that later on. But the way the language is built is making static analysis a lot easier. There's just a lot more information, a lot more verification that can be done at the language level if you compare to other formalism that exists out there on the market. And we can actually push that static analysis idea down to the concept of formal proof, where what you're trying to do is to define functional properties on the code and formally, mathematically verifying that in every circumstances of those properties hold. And again, pushed by our customers, we developed quite an expertise around the idea of certification. Our largest customer install base is in the Avionix domain, so we know a lot of things around D178 certification constraints, and we've actually adapted our technology to fit those constraints. And if you look at the groups that we member of, we member of the ARG, of course, which is standardizing the Ada language, but we member of the group that standardized D178C as well, and this is how we, one of the way we've been developing this know-how. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Ada language. That's a chart that presents the main versions of the language that have been developed. The first one was Ada 83. It was developed out of a DoD contract back in the late 70s to fulfill the U.S. defense domain requirements in terms of software development. And what's interesting is that if you look at the, I'm going to fast forward now, and if you look at the latest version of Ada 2012, the feature of the language that have been included here are specifically targeting reliability, safety, and security. If you look at the bullet points here that have been highlighted, we're talking about notions such as pre- and post-condition, invariant, which is really ways to extend the specification of your application at the programming level and tell to the program, this is the behavior that I'm expecting from the application. Now, once you get the ability to define this behavior, it gets a lot easier to verify it. I mean, if it's formally defined, it gets a lot easier to formally verify it as well. And that's kind of a new, it's kind of a shift in the language development, if you will. If you look at Ada 95 and Ada 2005, the focus was about developing new programming features. We had object annotation in 95. We have enhancements in programming structure in Ada 2005. And Ada 2012 was really, really concentrating on those aspects of safety and security. So let me actually show a couple of examples of what I mean by this extension of specification and contracts and so on and so on. We've got here extracts of Ada specification files that demonstrate this new programming by contract capability. So for example, if you look at this procedure P, which is the first box on the slide here, you'll notice that I have the procedure profile declared here. It's P takes two parameters, X, Y, that are of type integer. So that's the service, that's the API. But on top of this specification, I'm going to describe contracts, I'm going to describe constraints, and I'm going to say, for example, that as a precondition, X plus Y has to be above zero. And this is just a Boolean expression that defines the condition under which it's legal to call P. And then I can describe a post condition as well, which is kind of a guarantee, what is the guarantee that P provides after the call. And here I'm saying that the new value of G, which is here a global variable, has to be equal to the value before the call, incremented by 1. And those are very simple examples, but you can imagine that things can be much more complex into defining those things. That's an example of a contract on a sub-program or a function, if you will. We can have contracts on types as well. So, for example, this type even here says that for every value of even, I need to verify that value mod 2 equals 0. So I've created a type with gaps that only accepts even values. And, you know, again, this is pretty simple. It could get more interesting if you look at the very last example on this slide. I've got here an array type, and the contract I'm adding to this array, the behavior I'm expecting, the condition I'm expecting here is that this array is always sorted. And for that, I'm using quantifier, basically saying that for any value in the array, that value is smaller than the value of the next element. And for that, we have to expand the expressiveness of the language, of the expression of the language, to allow such things as quantifiers, saying that for all elements of a given assembly, this property will hold. Now, this tells you how to define those properties. And this obviously comes with some ways to verifying automatically those properties. And there are basically two ways to do this verification. One way is to do that through dynamic verification. In other words, turning those contracts into dynamic checks, maybe at unit tests or integration tests, or maybe you might want to even keep some of this after deployment to make sure that certain properties hold and you detect any break of those properties. So that's one way. Of course, you're going to pay a penalty in terms of execution time, because those things are going to have to be computed on the fly. Now, the alternative to that is to use formal proof. And we developed the Spark 2014 technology specifically for this objective. I won't go into the details of Spark, but just in two words, Spark is a subset of the Ada language, and that's a subset that is fully provable. So if you develop the application within a subset, all of a sudden, all of these contracts, all of these assertions can be verified. So in a nutshell, the improvements that Ada 2012 brought to the Ada language, and I would say brought to the software engineering overall, because there aren't that many languages that go this far in terms of expressing constraints, is really about improving specifications through contracts, helping readability, first of all, because then those contracts are explicit to the user. You expand the API with definition of the expected behavior on top of the services. That helps a lot to stability, because then those contracts, they can be turned on dynamically at test time or even sometimes at deployment, and they can be verified as to detect early on any inconsistency in the application flow, they help a lot static analysis because then that's additional information to check and take into account, and they can go up to enabling formal proof, formal verification, which is what we're doing with the Spark 2014 technology, which really is a refinement of ADA 2012. Now, just very quickly, because that's a question that often comes up, where is ADA today? And if you compare to 10 years ago or 20 years ago, what we're seeing, at least for the past 10 years, is that there's been a growing interest in the ADA language. We're seeing a lot of people coming to us because they recognize the fact that this technology solves a real problem to them. We're seeing existing ADA users to start with that are growing their usage of the language. I've got one customer in the Avionics domain, for example, which has an official policy whereby anything that hits the highest level of certification needs to be done with ADA, and they've had to migrate from C++ to ADA in a number of occasions because of that. Got customer returning to us. Got a couple of examples of people that tried other things about 10 or 15 or 20 years ago back then, where it was believed that the ADA language would die, and then after 10 years they realized that that wasn't the case, and that actually the other experiments that they've done were not that successful, so they're coming back to us. And then we see new projects. Mark had growing from C and was mentioning automotive. We have a lot of contacts there. Definitely in the past few years, we've got a lot more contacts than we used to be. We used to have. But this is the case as well in medical devices or industrial IoT, those sort of things. So coming back to today's topic, one of our strategic objectives, if you will, at ADA Core is to grow what we call the ADA ecosystem, because we only one player here, we only one vendor. We do development tools and verification tools, and that's pretty much our company focus today. So we need partners around us to complete the solution, so that if you select ADA, you can use this with state-of-the-art technology. So we're working a lot with OS vendors to make sure that we can port our technology to their environment with people such as Windriver, Cisco, Linksys, and so on and so forth. We work with partner company in the test and verification arena as well. And for example, we do have a coverage technology available, but we have partners such as Vectorcast, LDRA, or Rapita that do too, and we're very, very happy to share the marketplace with them. We work with modeling vendors, Rational IBM, for example, that has this UML to ADA code generator. We've been working more and more tightly with Simulink and Matrox recently. We work with service company as well. There are some places where our customer need the help from consultant or service companies, and we're here again to partner with those companies so that those services are available. And then, what brings us today is the need for us to partner with people developing libraries and middleware. And that's something that we've been that we've seen growing in our marketplace that we hear more and more about, which is the DDS middleware. It used to be something that was pretty much confined in some military application, at least from our point of view, where we stand in our ADA arena. And we're seeing more and more people today within the military domain and outside of the military domain. I'm pretty sure that David will talk a bit more about it, that are asking us about DDS, and they say, okay, well, could you have a DDS implementation? We'd like to use DDS and so on and so forth. And we recognize that that's just not our expertise, that's not our job. And we will look out, the RTI was the obvious partner to us. They've been having an AI implementation for years, and we're very, very excited that we're going to, it looks like we're going to grow the market and grow our shared customer base today. And without further ado, I guess, David, I'm going to pass the webinar over to you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Quentin. So what I'm going to do is, as Quentin says, DDS technology that I'm going to introduce complements ADA when it comes to developing mission-critical distributed systems with ADA. So what DDS The DDS standard addresses is how you communicate and share data and integrate different application components, subsystems, and systems that are part of a larger real-time system. So, for example, how the software that manages and controls your sensors might communicate with, you know, data processing or fusion applications, you know, applications doing control, applications that manage actuators. You know, all of these different system components have to communicate with each other. They have to share data. And that's really the problem that DDS addresses is, you know, how do you connect these things together from an application or software perspective? So DDS is a pure software solution. So if you look at the traditional approach to building distributed applications and communicating between different applications or components, you know, there's a variety of low-level interprocessor or IPC mechanisms available, you know, in modern operating systems. So you can use shared memory to communicate between different applications. You can use, you know, operating system level message queues. You can use things like, you know, TCP or UDP, usually through a socket interface if you're going between systems. And typically what communication mechanism has been chosen on a given project is based on, you know, how distributed that is. Are the components all running on the same processor, or are they running over a network or a bus, or what type of network? And typically application software is then written directly to what that interprocessor communication mechanism is. So there's very little separation between the application logic and the logic actually doing connectivity or integration between different components of a system. But there's a couple of problems with that traditional approach. One is it can be very expensive to develop that software, particularly over time as systems evolve and requirements evolve. So if you're, you know, writing whether you have a well-defined connectivity layer between your application and the transport, or whether you've kind of mingled your application and connectivity logic, you know, what you have to deal with in the application is things like how do you address different applications or modules, how do you discover them, what's available on the system at a given time, how do you know what if they make sure that those components are still there after you've discovered them, what's the health of the various components. Often there's problems of startup order dependence when you've got a distributed system, that things may have to come up in a certain order to work. If the underlying network isn't reliable, so perhaps you're using UDP or something like that, how do you get reliability when you need it? If you've got a mix of processors and operating systems and maybe even programming languages, you might not develop every component yourself. You know, how do you make sure those things can interoperate with each other? And then how do you handle, you know, things that could be, you know, disadvantaged networks where maybe you have reconnections, failover if things fail, you know, synchronizing state across different applications if they become connected and deconnected. So there's a lot of work, you know, typically you have to do in your own application or connectivity layer, you know, particularly, again, as systems scale up. So that's one of the challenges. Another is that based on what interprocessor communication mechanism or mechanisms you choose, your applications tend to be tightly coupled then to what the semantics of that underlying network are. So, for example, if you're using, you know, shared memory, it may store the last value of, you know, a particular data object or something like that. If you're using UDP, you get one-to-many communication, but it's not reliable. If you use TCP, it's reliable, but it's just one-to-one. So you have to make, you basically make assumptions in your application about what the proximity and underlying communication mechanism is, and then it becomes very very hard over time if that changes, if your assumption changes. So today I think I'm on the same node, so I'm going to use shared memory or an operating system message queue, but now I'm going to move and I'm going to be communicating across the network. You know, if I assume shared memory or message queue semantics and now I'm running over TCP or UDP, that's going to cause changes in the application. And then sort of along those lines, you know, with traditional approach to integration is each component knows about the other components that it's talking to. So we call that point-to-point integration. So if I'm a sensor, you know, I might know which specific applications need sensor data and explicitly send it to them. you know, or if I'm, you know, say a control application or a data fusion application, you know, I might know what sensors are out there and specifically request data from them. So you get this coupling between different components so that when you change one component, you have to go or add a component, you potentially have to go change and rework other components. And if you've got a certified system, that means you've got to then go recertify those components that you've changed. So what tends to happen over time as you add and change components in your system is these things become a lot more complex. You know, you get very stovepipe architectures, and they're very brittle, often to the point that in some old deployed systems you don't want to touch anything because you never know what you're going to break. So the potential complexity when doing point-to-point integration is really of order n squared. If I have, you know, n components in my system, there are potentially, it's n squared minus n connections between those components. So in a small system, it might be fine if I have, you know, four components. There's, you know, on the order of maybe, 16 or 12 potential connections. But as you scale up to a larger system with, say, you know, 20 or 30 or even 100 components, you can see that the complexity grows significantly. So these are the challenges that DDS is designed to address. So DDS stands for Data Distribution Service. It's a standard from the Object Management Group, and it's actually a family of standards. So there's about 10 standards now that are part of the DDS family, so it has a very active standardization community around it. So DDS basically provides a well-defined connectivity layer for your application, so it's a library that sits between your application and the underlying network transport or transports that you happen to be using. So DDS isn't tied, you know, say to shared memory or to TCP or UDP. DDS can run over a variety of different transports. And what it does is it decouples your application from the specific semantics of whatever that transport you're using it. So DDS has well-defined semantics that are independent of the transport, and you map those semantics onto each transport you're using, and we generally are the ones, RTI, that do that work of providing the adapters to different transports. So from an application perspective now, your applications are completely decoupled from what the underlying network type or physical communication mechanism is. So as applications may move around, so today I might be running on one node using shared memory, then you know, maybe tomorrow I've got to have those same two components that were on one node. Maybe now one's in the cloud somewhere halfway around the world, one's at the edge of the network. So I'm going to communicate, you know, over TCP, for example. I don't have to make any changes to my application at all to go do that redeployment. I just have to reconfigure DDS to know to use, you know, TCP instead of using shared memory, or in fact you can actually use both at the same time. So you can have be communicating at the same time over multiple transports. So the DDS standard itself has a standard application programming interface, the API that an application would use to call into the DDS library. And when used over TCP and UDP, there's also a standard interoperability protocol for DDS. So if you're using, there's many different implementations of the DDS standard out there. RTI is the leader, but there's others. They can interoperate with each other if those implementations support the interoperability protocol. And the interoperability protocol also then provides what I mentioned before, is that interoperability across different programming languages, you know, operating systems, CPU families. Also, it doesn't assume that the underlying network itself is reliable. So if you're using something like UDP, or maybe you're not using IP at all because you're going over a radio network or a satellite network with very limited bandwidth and that also is not reliable, DDS can accommodate that. It doesn't assume that the transport is reliable. So if you need reliable data delivery, DDS handles that at the middleware layer. It doesn't require that of the transport itself. So the paradigm that DDS uses to communicate between different applications is built on what's called publish-subscribe. So the way components communicate with each other, if I've got the software, say, that manages a sensor, controls a sensor, all I do is I publish sensor data. So I have a topic in my system called sensor data. And if I'm a sensor, I don't care who needs sensor data. I can just have a loop in my sensor saying publish, you know, well, the API call in DDS is write, but, you know, write sensor data, and I can either do that whenever that value changes, or I might do it at some specific periodicity. that's all my application that manages the sensor has to do. It doesn't care who needs sensor data. I just write sensor data, you know, at my prescribed rate or when there's a change. And then if I have a control application that needs that sensor data to do its control, all it does is it subscribes to sensor data. And now either at the rate that I specify or when the value changes, I'll just get that updated sensor data. And likewise, I could have an actuator in the system that I'm controlling, and I can publish commands to that actuator, and it would subscribe to commands. But none of these, there's no hard-coded knowledge across these different system components about what the other components are. Every component only really needs to know about the types of data or messages it produces and the types of data or messages it consumes. Because I'm not, my control app isn't explicitly talking to my actuator, it's just saying I'm publishing commands and my actuator knows I need commands, so it's subscribing to the commands. So these components are very loosely coupled. And the nice thing about this is as your system evolves, so for example, I add a new sensor and it's also publishing sensor data, it's the same type of sensor, my control application will now get that additional sensor data or has the ability to get that additional sensor data based upon, you know, what criteria around data it specifies it needs. Likewise, I might want to add a display application to my system. So if I add that display application and maybe I want to show, you know, my HMI, show here's the current value of all the sensors, you know, maybe here's the status of my actuators, you know, or the health. So it can just subscribe to those topics and I don't have to make changes to any other existing applications. It's just going to get that data, you know, off of the network or IPC mechanism, and it's completely transparent to any other applications. You don't have to change your source code. If things are recertified at the component level, you don't need to recertify those components. You might still have to do some recertification at the system level depending on what your certification requirements are, but you don't have to change any of the software running in those individual components. So it would only be certifying the new components and whatever system level certification you have to do. And also this approach of loose coupling also makes systems very easy to test because it's easy to simulate these missing components. We actually provide a tool called Prototyper that lets you emulate the behavior of a component that may not exist yet, as well as things like a recording service that can just record data being sent over the DDS, you know, what we call software data bus, and also replay data if you want to do, you know, testing against, you know, change your algorithms and you want to do some replaying of historic data, you can do that and see what the changes in behavior are. So this is an example from one of our customers that moved from their legacy approach using point-to-point integration to DDS. So this was the U.S. Navy NAVAIR that's responsible for airframes. So this is a Hawkeye, the E2C. So why did they move to DDS? So as I described before, they had there's a lot of different components, modules on board the aircraft. So this is the different software subsystems within the aircraft, and you can see they traditionally use point-to-point integration between these components and these lines, reflect all the different communication paths in their system. When they wanted to add a new capability to the system called the cooperative engagement capability that needed to communicate with other existing modules, what they discovered is, oh, we have to go change all of these components that were already deployed so that they know how to communicate with the new CEC component. So they looked at, you know, various approaches to how to do that. You know, one was, you know, kind of using more of an object-oriented approach, but they discovered that that in and of itself didn't really solve the problem because things still needed to know about other things. And that's kind of when they discovered DDS and the publish-subscribe model. So basically by removing those point-to-point connections and using topic-based publish-subscribe, all the modules could now be decoupled from each other. They didn't have to go change and do rework upon different modules. So again, this slide is their words, but it's really about an architecture, you know, that could assimilate evolving functionality, you know, as their system and requirements changed and as they added new capabilities. It eliminated the need to do all the rework when they wanted to evolve the system. So that's kind of the traditional publish-subscribe model. DDS does provide a couple of extensions over that module we call data-centric publish-subscribe. So with data-centric publish-subscribe, DDS itself maintains the state of all the data objects in your system because using DDS, it's almost in a sense like using a database, although there's some very key implementation differences. So applications, what they do is they write and read to data objects. So data objects are divided into topics, as I mentioned before, which might correlate to a type of data, like, you know, specific types of sensor data would have its own topic. Then within each topic, I have values of different objects that might be, you know, say tracks or something that I'm tracking in my application. Each of those tracks is identified by a key, and a key could be multiple fields or parameters within that data object that uniquely identifies it. And what DDS does is it keeps the last value, or actually the last n values. You can keep historic values for each data object. So as an application, I just write the latest value of a data object if I'm a producer. I can read or take the latest value of data object if I'm a consumer. And what DDS does is it makes sure that the state of that, this what we call a global data space, is synchronized across different applications. So every application, just like when you're using a database, has a consistent view of the world. So you don't have synchronization problems. So if an application, you know, maybe for some reason it leaves the system, it loses network connectivity, or it fails for some reason and then rejoins, it automatically gets a current snapshot of the system state. So you don't have to use some out-of-band mechanism to say, hey, give me the last, you know, value or end values of these data objects. It can, when it joins, it requests how much historic data it needs and what data it needs, and it automatically is synchronized with that data. And it's also very efficient because then you don't need to, if you're using kind of a traditional messaging system and you often need a bunch of historic messages to reconstruct state, and in a real-time system that data might be coming, you know, too fast to store. There could be, you know, real-time reasons or resource reasons. You don't want to store more data than you need. So DDS eliminates the need to have to sort of keep or persist every single message so you can reconstruct state. It maintains the current state itself. But it does it in a completely distributed fashion. So DDS doesn't have a central database anywhere in the system. Each individual application caches the data that it publishes or subscribes. So the underlying architecture is still completely decentralized with DDS. There's no single point of failure, for example, in a DDS system. Each data, each node or each application just maintains its own cache of the required data. So DDS is very well suited to modular open architecture systems, as I've implied. So the interfaces between different components in the system are very well defined. So what those schema are around your different topics, for example. So part of the DDS standard is the language for defining what your data types look like. So OMG has what's called an interface definition language, IDL. So you can define your types using OMG IDL. I'll just show an example of that in a minute. Or you can use XML to define your data types. Then based on what programming language you're using, you use a compiler to translate from these abstract definitions into types in the specific programming language that you're using for type safety reasons. So if you're using Ada, you would take the IDL definition of your types and translate that to Ada. If you were interoperating, say, with a component written in Java, you'd use a similar procedure there. You translate IDL to Java, and then you're now using a consistent type across Java and Ada, and DDS is making sure that those can interoperate with each other. And DDS is very widely used in open architecture initiatives. So I kind of mentioned a few here that are in the U.S. There's also in Europe, the generic vehicle architecture also uses DDS. And for those doing avionics software, there's an emerging standard called FACE, Future Airborne Capability Environment. And RTI also provides an implementation of the FACE, as it defines its own API, and we provide an implementation of that API on top of our underlying DDS library so that DDS and FACE applications can also interoperate with each other. So often DDS is added to existing systems. It's rare that somebody starts a whole new large system of systems from scratch. So RTI provides technology to facilitate migration of existing systems to DDS. So obviously, if you're writing new applications or updating applications, in those applications, you can just natively call the DDS API and directly embed the DDS libraries. But it might be sort of on the right-hand side of this slide that you have components that are already deployed that you don't want to change. So in this case, we provide something we call a routing service that has an adapter framework as part of it. And rather than modifying existing applications, which again, in some cases, you may not control, they might be things you have to integrate with, you know, with suppliers or customers or other partners, you can mediate between whatever protocol or interfaces those applications or components use and DDS, so that when it goes out over the network or bus, everything is normalized to DDS in your common data model, but then you adapt to what your legacy or existing interfaces in the system are, pre-existing interfaces, so you don't have to change portions that are already certified and deployed, for example. You can adapt those, and then over time, you know, as you update those existing modules, they can then move to natively use DDS. So most customers using DDS have some combination of new existing components that they need to interoperate using this approach. We have extreme cases, you know, where a customer, you know, is purely just using the routing service, so they're just using DDS as an integration framework, and many, you know, few if any of the applications actually natively use DDS. So you can do it both ways. Everything can natively use DDS. You could just use DDS as your kind of backbone integration bus. Typically, it's a combination of those two in a real system. DDS is very well suited to mission critical and safety critical systems. So as I mentioned before, the architecture is completely decentralized. There's no single point of failure, single point of failover. You know, all the applications in your system or in a given subsystem communicate peer to peer. So it also keeps latency and jitter very low. DDS also, as I mentioned earlier, supports multiple networks. So it could be I have multiple networks because I might be communicating, you know, using shared memory with another local component. I might be communicating over a wide area network with a remote component, but I also might have redundant networks for failover purposes. So I could have multiple Ethernets, for example, that the same component is communicating over, so that if one fails, I can fail over to the backup. So the whole idea behind DDS is you've got no single point of failure anywhere in your system. And then also because of the loose coupling in DDS, in fact, that there's no single point of failure, I can dynamically upgrade a system. So I can, you know, remove a component or add a component to the system without having to stop and restart any other component or upgrade any other component. It also provides very comprehensive control into real-time quality of service. So Quentin mentioned Ada having contracts. DDS also has the equivalent of contracts. So as a publisher, I specify this is the data I produce and the rate that I produce it. As a subscriber, I say this is the rate that I need data. So we'll only establish communication if those contracts match. And in the event that the contracts don't match, we'll let the application know. And in the event that I have a contract, say I'm going to deliver data at 100 hertz, I'm going to subscribe at 100 hertz. If you don't meet that, so a message is a sample is lost, for example, you get a notification that, hey, the contract wasn't satisfied. So it's a way you can kind of monitor the health of a system. You get visibility to missed deadlines and presents, for example, that you need in a critical real-time system. And DDS is used today in thousands of different mission-critical systems. We also have an implementation that's certifiable to DO178C Level A and has been evaluated successfully by certification authorities to DO178C. So kind of summarizing some of the benefits are kind of another example. This is a U.S. Army asset tracking system that originally took the approach of developing its own middleware, which was developed over 8 years. So just the integration infrastructure had 500,000 lines of code, so this isn't even counting the applications itself. This is really just the way that they were integrated with each other. And you can see that they were able to track about 20,000 objects, updates a second to objects. But it was never a completely reliable system, and they had uptime challenges. So in switching over to DDS, which took them just a few weeks to get a proof of concept running and around a year to get the whole system running, they were able to reduce that custom code from 500,000 lines of code to 50,000 lines of code. And what had taken 21 servers to run, using the data-centric publish-subscribe approach and the efficiency of DDS, they could actually demonstrate that on a single laptop. Obviously, for reliability purposes, they're not really going to run on one laptop. And they were able to go from 20,000 objects a second to 250,000 objects a second with much higher reliability, again, with no single point of failure on DDS. So kind of an example of some of the value that kind of a real-world application got from DDS. So kind of just quick overview of RTI's product line. So we do have a couple different DDS implementations. So our Connects DDS Professional includes a complete implementation of the DDS standard, as well as things like the routing service I mentioned before and some of the tools I mentioned, like recording and replay services, integration with Excel, ways to visualize data, for example. We have some extensions to that, our Connect DDS Secure product, which adds a very rich security model to it. We have a small footprint version designed to run on microcontrollers that, you know, may have very limited resource, like 256K of RAM or something. And then our DO178C certifiable version, which is a subset of the micro product. So this is our product family. Now, because on the network, they're all using the DDS interoperability protocol, they can interoperate. And likewise, from an application perspective, they all support the common DDS API. So looking at our Ada support, we do support Ada 2012 with the Ada Core GNAP Pro development environment. And as I mentioned before, in DDS, you typically define your types using, you know, IDL or XML, so our compiler generates those specific Ada interfaces from your IDL definition, and again, fully interoperable across the different languages we support. So I just want to kind of walk you through a quick example here. So this example uses something we call the RTI Shapes demo, which you can download from our website here. And this is kind of just a little demo application that, you know, if you want to learn more about DDS, this is usually where I recommend you start, because it lets you kind of publish and subscribe to data. And what you don't see here is you can play around with the different quality of service properties that DDS has, real-time quality of service properties, without having to do any programming. So it's sort of a great way to kind of learn what DDS is. So this is the type that is used in that Shapes demo application. So it's basically, it's publishing the position of shapes. So there's, you know, the shape has a, so there's three topics in the system, you know, squares, circles, triangles. Different objects are identified by a color. And then you've got your X and Y and size coordinates. So this is in using the OMG interface definition language, which we then use our IDL compiler, we translate that to Ada, and this is what your Ada code would look like to actually publish or write data of this topic. So you see here, we're generating the Ada types where you just populate, you know, the X value, you know, the Y value, the size of the shape, and the color here, and then you just write the value of that data, and then DDS is doing all that work under the hood. So you just write the current value, DDS makes sure that any subscriber gets that data. Similarly, it works on the subscribing or reception side. Basically, you're just taking a data object, which in this case it's a sequence of objects because you may have received multiple updates at the same time. So I just take those objects and then I can iterate through the sequence to see what all the latest value of that particular object is. And again, you can do a take or a read in DDS. So a take removes it from the cache so you won't see the same data again, or you can just read it if you just want to periodically pull for the last value. You can also get updates synchronously or asynchronously. So to kind of summarize, you know, Connect DDS, it provides a standards compliant way to do data distribution, connectivity, and integration in a mission-critical real-time system focused on reducing lifecycle costs of both development, initial development, integration of systems, but also reducing the cost of ongoing maintenance and evolution over time, designed specifically for to meet the requirements of real-time and mission-critical systems, and very well integrated with Ada 2012 and the Ada Core development environment. So if you want to give it a shot, I earlier mentioned the Shapes demo. We also have a download on our website where you can download our complete Connect DDS professional product. For the Ada bindings to that product, you can email info@rti.com, so they're not part of that default download. But if you download it and want to use it with Ada, just contact RTI. So it's info@rti.com. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and I will turn it back over to you, Brandon.
Great. Thanks, David. Great presentation, both of you. That brings us into our Q&A portion of the event. So I want to remind the audience that this is the time to ask your questions, ask away. We have about 10 minutes, and we'll get through as many of them as we can. So question number one, here's a question that comes up a lot when we're discussing DDS for David. How does DDS deal with security issues? It's a big question, obviously, but how would you tackle answering that question?
Sure. So there's a couple ways to deal with security and DDS. I'd say the classic approach is to use transport layer security with DDS, so things like, you know, TLS, SSL, or things like IPsec. The new approach is there is now a DDS security standard that RTI supports that provides a very rich security model for DDS that actually provides control over, it gives you access control over who can publish and subscribe to what topics in your system. Does authentication, and it supports multicast, which transport layer security doesn't do for one-to-many distribution. So kind of depending on your application requirements, you can take both approaches to security. You can either do security at the DDS layer using DDS security capabilities, or you can do security at the transport layer.
Great. So transport layer communications are encrypted between with using DDS between various nodes.
Correct.
Great. All right. Here's one for you, Quentin. Why don't you think that ADA has been more widely adopted? You know, if you look around industry, people have a lot of success with ADA in terms of bugs and flaws versus C or C sharp. What's your take on that? And is there a steep learning curve? How do you propose to get it more more uptake in industry, I guess?
Actually, ADA is quite easy to learn. I mean, part of my activities as ADA car is train, and you know, usually get reasonable C developer within a week. They're operational in the ADA language. It's quite easy to pick up. I think it's a cultural or historical reason, if you will. Usually, people don't necessarily think about reliability at the very beginning when they pick up a language, and then when they start to pick, you know, to think about reliability, it's often a bit later in the process, and it's too late to switch language. So I guess historically, you know, definitely in the past decades, people have been less sensibilized or concerned by reliability than I would say they are now. As a result, ADA has lived very well and strong in this niche where, you know, people knew about it and it was kind of the default in a lot of situations,
right,
particularly in the A&D domain, not so much outside of that. But that being said, as I was mentioning earlier, in the past 5 to 10 years, at least what I've witnessed as part of the ADA core team is a definite increase of the concern on reliability and an increase of the interest in ADA in this regard. So what we're seeing is definitely more and more people picking it up. So, you know, maybe I can give you a more interesting answer to this one in 5 to 10 years.
Great. Thanks. David, back to you. So there's a company that's interested in possibly the ability to publish mutations of objects using DDS as opposed to publishing the entire object. Is that possible?
Yes, it is. There's a variety of different ways to do that. So we'd probably have to look at the specific requirements there. But I think even if you looked at the example I showed, you can have some portions of, say, your structures that are optional, for example, that, may not change. So, yes, DDS does provide a number of ways to do that. It also has concepts like, sequences and things like that, can have variable length.
Great. All right. Reminder to the audience, keep your questions coming. We'll get to as many of them as we can in the time remaining. Back to you again, David. This is question that's somewhat easy to answer, but give your take. How do you see DDS fitting into the IoT?
DDS has actually been fairly widely adopted for the IoT and particularly the industrial side of the Internet of Things. So if you look at things like, medical devices, both for things like medical device interoperability, like in an operating room or patient room, applications like robotic surgery, medical imaging have been very popular for DDS, as well as things like the power grid, which are, increasingly leveraging IoT-type technologies and architectures, so DDS is widely used there, in transportation, so, cars, trains, planes. So, you know, RTI, there is an organization called the Industrial Internet Consortium that's setting a lot of the standards for the, or guidance for the industrial side of the Internet of Things. So RTI has been very active in the IIoT. And yes, we actually have, if you go to our website and the, I think it's the resources section, you'll see we have quite a few webinars we've done on the use of DDS in industrial internet, industrial IoT applications.
Excellent. All right, Quentin. More questions about Ada and how it compares to maybe C. Can you give me a kind of a comparison, a quick sort of benchmark in terms of performance using Ada versus
okay.
C?
Okay. In terms of the execution time. Well, it's actually more a question on the actual underlying technology than the language themselves. I mean, there's nothing in the language itself that makes it fundamentally slower or faster, for that matter, than C if you compare things that are comparable. One thing that often confuses people is that by default with Ada, you have so-called runtime checks that are enabled. So, for example, when you do an assignment to variable, you verify that the value is within the expected range and stuff like that. And, of course, if you compare a program that keeps checking itself with C, which doesn't do such check, you might find that the Ada program is going to run a little slower than the C program. But those checks are by no means mandatory, and if you want to disconnect it, you know, for example, after deployment to optimize the application, you'll find that, you know, it's pretty similar. And if you look at technology in particular, at Ada Core, a large portion of our Ada compiler is actually shared with the GCC C compiler. So again, if you configure Ada to be at the same semantic level as C in terms of automatic checking, you'll find that there's no significant differences between the two languages. The optimization are the same, and the overall speed of the application is the same if you're doing the same thing.
Excellent. All right, David. Here's a question. You talked about we've talked about TCP and touched a little bit on UDP. Does DDS have the ability to communicate using less common protocols or different ones?
Yes, it does. So DDS has in it what we call a pluggable transport interface. So it isn't, the core of it isn't tied to any specific protocol like TCP or UDP. So there's some things we support out of the box like TCP and UDP. But if you have a different transport you're using, like you just want to run over your bus or something like MPLS, then either you or we could use that pluggable transport interface to create an adapter for that specific protocol. So again, DDS does not make a lot of assumptions about what the capability of that underlying protocol or transport is. So it doesn't even have to be reliable, for example. So so one could develop a adapter or pluggable transport for MPLS, for example. And it's quite possible customers have done that. We don't have visibility into what transports our customers run over in all cases.
Okay. And Quentin, back to you. We kind of touched on this briefly a couple questions ago, but how do you see adoption in Ada 2012 taking place?
Okay. So I need to take this one as within the Ada community, how people are migrating to new versions. That's interesting because we. With the previous version of Ada, Ada 05, we have a little bit of adoption from the Ada market, but not that much. And with Ada 2012, the picture is quite different. And we see people moving from Ada 83 directly to Ada 2012 just for the purpose of taking advantage of this new feature, this contract. And they don't do anything else that Ada can bring them in this new version. So we're seeing a large amount of our customers that are adopting this new standard, which is something new to us.
Great. All right. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. For those of you who had questions that we weren't able to get to in the allotted time, we'll make sure to have the appropriate representatives follow up. I want to thank our speakers today, Quentin Oshem of Ada Core and David Barnett of Real-Time Innovations, guiding us through some of those mission-critical development considerations. We at Open Systems Media, RTI, and Ada Core would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some excellent questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCast available for download there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a great day.